First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
A Florida man is released from a jail in Saudi Arabia, just as an expert on U.S.-Saudi relations speaks here in town tonight. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2, and I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we speak with journalist and author Graham Wood on Saudi Arabia and extremism here at home and around the world. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, don't miss our ticket giveaway for the Jack's Jumbo Shrimp home opener. Yes, that's later in the hour. That and more ahead this morning. But first today, a 72-year-old American who was imprisoned for more than a year in Saudi Arabia over tweets that he made that were critical of the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Well, that American is back with family members this morning in Riyadh, the Saudi capital. It isn't clear, though, whether the kingdom will drop a travel ban to allow him to return home. Saad Al-Mahdi is a dual U.S.-Saudi citizen, and until he was arrested, a retiree living here in Florida. Now, at the same time, the only U.S. journalist since COVID began to ever interview bin Salman is actually in town tonight. In that interview, they spoke broadly about the region, the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and President Joe Biden's strategy in the Middle East. Graham Wood speaks tonight on the UNF campus on the complicated U.S.-Saudi relationship. The event is part of the World Affairs Council's Global Issues Speakers Series. Wood is an author and a correspondent for The Atlantic, and he joins us now on the line with a preview. Graham, what a pleasure.
It's great to be here.
A little later in the hour, we'll also check in with the World Affairs Council about this series. And the number to join us is 549-2937. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. So, Graham, before we get into your interview with bin Salman and your expertise on the region, I first wanted to ask you about this news breaking this morning, this Florida man, actually, who made some tweets critical of Saudi Arabia's leadership and was thrown in jail for that. We don't know yet whether he'll be allowed to return home to Florida anytime soon. But how symbolic is this whole dust up, do you think, of how things tend to go with U.S.-Saudi relations?
Well, it's something that happens all the time within Saudi Arabia. What's unique about it, almost unique, is that it's happening to someone who's also a Florida man, an American. If you're a Saudi citizen, you almost certainly would have heard in your immediate social circle it's happening so frequently that of cases of people who have been found to have said something critical about the crown prince, something critical about the kingdom. And if they are not actually directly taken away under arrest, they're subject to travel bans that are like this. And often they just find out at the airport. They have their passport scanned to leave, and the official says, with a shrug, says, here, you can't leave. And that could be for the rest of your life. It could be for a few weeks, a few months. But that means you're on the government's radar, and that is not good for you, not good for your family, not good for your life.
It's really anathema to Americans. We're used to a broad range of freedoms. And when we look at a kingdom like Saudi Arabia, we just are baffled and really, frankly, most of us horrified at their human rights abuses, their subjugation of women. And yet, we, as Americans dependent on their oil, accept so much of it. You're an expert on this delicate dance, the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and you'll be speaking about that tonight at UNF. Can you explain a little bit about, for people that aren't really very familiar with it, the longstanding agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, the exchange we make with them, security for oil?
Yeah, that has been the essence of the deal for a long time. In fact, even before the discovery of oil, there was before oil really came online in Saudi Arabia, there was a kind of friendship that the United States had with Saudi Arabia, and it's lasted. And of course, it has been defined by the oil relationship since the 1950s. What we've done, though, is we've said, you allow us to exploit oil, and they said, we will allow you to come into the kingdom and in a limited way interact with us. But we don't want you to change our culture. We don't want you to change our religion. We don't want you to to colonize us. We want you to give us money in exchange for that oil, in exchange for the expertise of taking it out of the ground. Now, that deal has meant that there's many aspects of Saudi culture that are simply pre-modern. They do not correspond with our values, with Western values, European values. And as a result, we've had to kind of look the other way during successive waves of deep religious conservatism and social conservatism in the kingdom. That has, interestingly enough, sort of changed, though, in the last 5 years or so with MBS, the Crown Prince. And you know, we talked about the crackdown on dissent. Much of that dissent actually comes from religious conservatives and people who actually kind of liked that pre-modern way of running the country that had existed for most of the time that we've known Saudi Arabia as a country. So MBS has come in and said, all right, we're going to modernize. Many of the things that Americans were aghast at, like making sure that women couldn't travel on their own or even drive cars, we're just stopping that. We are allowing all that to happen in exchange for some guarantee of security, in exchange for the guarantee that our alliance with the United States continues, and that against regional foes like Iran, you will defend us. So it's quite a bargain that we started off with and that we continue to have, but the nature of it's really changed in the last 5 years.
Mm. You sat down and interviewed Mohammed bin Salman. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, so MBS was, the blame was pinned on him for the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who's a friend of mine. And as a result, he just really shut up. I mean, he had been on this tour around the world, going to world capitals, going to Silicon Valley, and he couldn't really leave his house, couldn't really leave Saudi Arabia without someone coming up to him and asking him about Jamal Khashoggi. So he wasn't talking to many people. I did get a chance to interview him. I spent several hours in his presence, was allowed to ask any questions. So I actually led with questions about Jamal Khashoggi and got a chance to find out exactly how he was thinking about the kingdom, how he was thinking about this relentless criticism of him, and also just kind of get a sense of him as a man, because he will be the absolute ruler of Saudi Arabia, and much depends on what his personality is. And I found that he was thin-skinned, is very intelligent, I think rather more westernized than I expected him to be. His English is very good. And he was utterly unapologetic about every aspect of Saudi Arabia that I think people have been most critical of him for. He certainly defended himself against domestic criticism for being less conservative socially than his predecessors. But he also said, look, we are bringing this kingdom into the current century, or at least the last century. And that is something that's going to be difficult. People are not going to like it. And he said, we have no choice but to be firm with dissent. And so he said it was going to go like that going forward. It was really an incredible thing, because for years, certainly nobody within the kingdom felt safe asking him questions. Nobody from outside the kingdom had the opportunity to ask him questions. And there I was, able to ask the questions everybody wanted to know the answer to, but were afraid to ask.
What did he say to you about Khashoggi's murder? Did he cop to it?
No, he didn't. I said to him directly, look, the United States intelligence community, with information far beyond what I personally have as a journalist, has said they think there's no way you weren't involved. Tell us what's going on. And he said some things that were, I thought, at least off-key. Strange. He said, look, I never read an article by Jamal Khashoggi. And, you know, killing him, I certainly am not responsible for it. And indeed, when he died, it was one of the worst things that's happened to me since I came to office. So many of the normal human reactions to, hey, you were just accused of dismembering someone, expressing sympathies with his family and so forth, were not among his first reactions. They were to say, you know, he just wasn't very high on my target list. I wouldn't have done that. And if I did do it, he said, then I would have done it very, very professionally, not in this slapdash way that happened.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with journalist and author Graham Wood of The Atlantic. Wood speaks tonight, courtesy of the World Affairs Council, about the U.S.-Saudi relationship. The number to join us, 549-2937. Graham, let me ask you about golf for a minute. We're in North Florida, where golf is kind of a big deal. There has been increasing backlash to anyone who supports LIV Golf, the Saudi-backed golf tournament. That's been a big discussion point out at the PGA Tour here in Arpana Vedra. Former President Donald Trump is affiliated with LIV Golf, another Florida man who may be indicted soon, by the way. Will you be touching on this aspect of U.S.-Saudi relations in your talk?
I will be, yes. I mean, LIV Golf is a fascinating subject among many fascinating subjects. And you know, the hard feelings about it that you get from the PGA side, that's a pretty good reflection of how many other people in many other sectors think about MBS and his reforms. They see him as a guy who's come into a system that works and who has said, I'm going to do things differently. I don't care what you think about it. And has said, I've got enough money where I can just make that happen. And so this is one, golf is one set of disruptions that are associated with MBS. And MBS, you know, the number of these things is immense. Remember that, as you alluded to, Saudi Arabia was a religiously conservative kingdom where you couldn't even open a movie theater. And he's opening up movie theaters. He's having rap concerts. He's having professional wrestling competitions where people beat each other with folding chairs. And so there's changes everywhere and people upset about every single one of them. So with LIV Golf, yes, this is a huge enterprise. It's a lot of money, but money is something that MBS has, and he's also used to criticism. So he's absolutely pushing forward. And, you know, this is just one case of a subject where he's broken eggs and other people are slipping on them.
Mm. And the pressure to distance from LIV Golf here in the U.S. is pretty intense. Even greater than the pressure the government might feel lately to look the other way at their human rights abuses. People that throw in with LIV Golf get a lot of blowback.
Yeah, MBS is an incredibly polarizing figure outside of Saudi Arabia, and to maybe a slightly even lesser extent inside Saudi Arabia. So he has been essentially saying to the outside world, look, I'm going to do these things. I'm going to be a harsh, brutal ruler inside the kingdom, but I'm also going to make the kingdom a bit more like you, a bit more like you've been asking Saudi Arabia to be. So you just better accept that deal because it's the best one you're ever going to get. And people don't like to be spoken to in these kind of mafioso-like tones. At the same time, in Saudi Arabia, there's a lot of young people there who know what the outside world is like, don't think it's satanic, and want to have a country that's a bit more like it. So they, too, many of them are very supportive of MBS. So, you know, strong feelings about LIV Golf, there's strong feelings about every aspect of what MBS has done, strong feelings about the manner in which he's done it, again, speaking in a kind of gangster-like way to other groups. And yeah, he's a deeply polarizing figure, and I'm not surprised that there's strong feelings about him.
You know, as we talk about Saudi Arabia, just this week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, came out with yet another dire report saying that the window is basically closing to get off fossil fuels quickly. And if we don't, we're going to be facing cascading horrible effects for future generations on this planet. Can you talk a little bit about what it means for a kingdom like Saudi Arabia when this world finally gets serious about getting off fossil fuels, turning to alternative sources of energy, which we will be eventually forced to do?
Yeah, Saudi Arabia, of course, is entirely run on oil. All the money comes from oil. That is the economy. And Saudi Arabia, by the way, in addition to having enormous reserves, just as important is the fact that it can increase or decrease the amount of oil it produces pretty much at will. And it's kind of unique in that regard. Many other countries have lots of oil, but are producing it to the max. Saudi Arabia introduces that ability to act as a kind of oil central banker. So I think there's no kidding themselves about the importance of oil in their economy, the importance of oil for decades to come, no matter how green anyone tries to be. But they do realize that as they open up, as they try to get other countries to be friendly with them, that other countries do care about the climate, about the disfoliation of the earth and the atmosphere. And so part of their PR blitz is to try to create new green initiatives within Saudi Arabia. Another thing that they have in abundance is sunlight. So having green cities is something that is at least on the horizon for them, for perhaps nothing other than PR reasons. But they're building a city in the desert. They expect it, want it to have millions of people living there. And it's supposed to be the greenest city ever built. So it's a issue that they're sensitive to, even if fundamentally it's not part of their portfolio.
How do you talk to Americans who express frustration with our, critics would call it a cozy relationship with Saudi Arabia, given that they did have a hand in the 9/11 attacks on this country?
Yeah, so MBS is a young man. He's 37 years old. And as I say, he speaks English, so which means that unlike other previous crown princes, which were old guys born in tents, very canny, intelligent political leaders, but not of the Western world, MBS is aware of that criticism. And I think in some ways, what we see in his current political program is an answer to it. So when I talk to Americans who think of Saudi as this sinister country that's all screwed up, that's stuck in the Stone Age, then I have to remind them, MBS is answering many of those criticisms. If you were to ask an American in 2003, 2004, when the memory of the September 11 attacks was even fresher than it is now, then they would have said, look, this is a country that's extremely supportive of Islamists abroad. It's supportive of policies that make its own citizens very unhappy. And that's something that's got to stop. MBS actually has stopped that. That's what is the really interesting bargain that he represents, is that many of the things that Americans hated about Saudi Arabia are changing because of MBS. And he is saying, I will make these changes. You will like that I made these changes because you've been asking them for them for decades. But in exchange, you will give me a blank check to be brutal toward my own citizens into whatever degree I please. But the reward for that is that my country, which you've been asking to be more modern, to be more secular, that's exactly what you're going to get. But along the way, some people are going to get hurt, and you're not allowed to whine about that.
Now, at the same time as you speak tonight about Saudi Arabia, I'm wondering if you'll also touch on why people, and I know you've spoken about this before, why people are drawn to extremist ideologies, not just in the Middle East, but here in this country, too, and how we've seen a rise in that around the world.
Yes, extremist ideologies has been a subject of my work for some time, and I wrote about Americans who went to travel to ISIS. I've written about people with other extreme ideologies in this country and elsewhere. And, you know, it's been a source of deep fascination to me that I can understand why someone who has no life, say someone in Saudi Arabia who lived in a fundamentally boring and horrible place, might look for outlets for that elsewhere. What's really shocking and that's taken a bit more imagination to understand is why that type of ideology is even appealing to people who live in nice places like Florida, places like London. And indeed, there is some subset of the population that longs for more and that I think is just deeply unhappy with living in the modern world, living a comfortable life, and seeks strain on their lives, seeks something that is much deeper. And yes, Saudi Arabia, for a long time, it encouraged such people. It gave them places where they could train to fight, and they made a deal with them. They said, we're going to subsidize extremism overseas so that it doesn't attack us at home. As long as you don't attack us at home, we're fine. And that deal kind of broke up after September 11, when when there were attacks, of course, on the United States, the Saudi patron. And then a few years later, when, of course, the chickens came home and roosted in the form of attacks in Saudi Arabia. So it's all intertwined. The desire of people for to be part of an extreme cause, and the desire of countries to put off reckoning with those desires in their own citizens and in others.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Graham Wood of The Atlantic. Wood speaks tonight as part of the World Affairs Council's Global Issues Evening Series about the U.S.-Saudi relationship. His talk is at UNF at 7 o'clock. It's 549-2937 to join us. All right, let's turn now to John Alaska of the World Affairs Council. This is an example of the kind of speakers you bring to town.
Yeah, this is great. And, you know, I think in general this season there's sort of been this through line of really strong, gutsy people that we've been bringing to town. You know, it just strikes me that, you know, not shortly after Jamal Khashoggi was brutally murdered, Graham Wood went to the place, Saudi Arabia, and spoke to the person who many believe ordered his killing. And, you know, to go to a place that is not welcoming to journalists takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of strength. And what's so great about events like tonight is that this is more than just news coverage. You're talking to someone who has real perspective, real skin in the game when it comes to these issues. And it's not going to be just headlines. It's going to be really interesting stories and insights about a man who has a lot more mythology about him, MBS, than actual knowledge.
You know, it is election day in Jacksonville. People are choosing a new mayor, other local officials. Local issues are very important, of course. But the World Affairs Council seeks to bring the world to this region with these kinds of events. Can you talk about that mission?
Yeah, you know, we really view the idea that having a strong Jacksonville includes having a global Jacksonville, being an international city. And we also view these events like tonight, our Global Issues Evenings, as a real opportunity for people who might disagree on issues to come together to listen to someone like Graham Wood and have conversations after. And, you know, local politics is exceptionally important. But when we can promote civil discourse, I think it makes our community stronger, and it does hopefully make our local politics better as well. And so, you know, it all goes together.
Still any tickets left for tonight? How can people be part of this evening?
Yes. So we have tickets left for tonight. They can go to worldaffairscouncil.jax.org, but it'll be on the front page of our website. Tickets are complimentary. We just ask that you reserve so we can make sure we have a seat for you.
Oh, free tickets. You can't beat that. Now, Graham, you have received so many flowers, laurels for your work, including this most recent profile of MBS. What's next for you? What are you working on for your next book or piece as you continue in your path?
Well, I did get flowers and laurels from some, not from the Saudis. They were
not I bet not.
So one of the things that I've long wanted to do is actually return to Saudi Arabia and see how this is progressing, because, you know, this is part of a vision that MBS has had for 2030, and we're getting pretty close to 2030. So the change is something that I think is world historical, and it's really important to keep on chronicling that, and I'll continue to do that. I'm also moving back into the extremism beat. So after having written a lot about ISIS and about jihadism, I've found strains of extremism elsewhere that are equally deeply deeply held on the parts of their adherents. And so I'll be talking to more people who have those views and finding out where they get them and where it's taking them.
And that'll be foreign extremists, not domestic ones?
It could be both. I mean, one of the things about extremisms is they tend not to really respect national borders. And so these are people who have a view of the world that goes well beyond the lines on a map.
Well, thank you for sharing a preview of tonight's talk with us. He's Graham Wood of The Atlantic. He'll speak tonight at UNF on the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Graham Wood and John Alaska of the World Affairs Council. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, don't miss our ticket giveaway for the Jumbo Shrimp home opener. That's later, but up next.
Before 1972, women were not permitted to serve as FBI agents. Two females in 1972, after Hoover passed away, went for the first time to the FBI Academy.
Jacksonville's FBI office celebrates Women's History Month. We'll be right back. Well, March is Women's History Month, and to celebrate, FBI Jacksonville Special Agent in Charge, Sherry Unks, will welcome a visit in a few days from Susan Rowley Malone. Now, Malone was the first woman to graduate from the FBI Academy back in 1972. In addition to meeting with FBI employees here in town, Malone will join Unks at the FBI Jacks Diversity Agent Recruitment Event coming up Thursday. I spoke with Unks about women rising in the ranks of the FBI and law enforcement. Take a listen. Agent Sherry Unks, good to be with you this Women's History Month. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So you are the special agent in charge at the Jacksonville FBI office, and you recently welcomed Susan Rowley Malone to town. She was one of the very first women to graduate from the FBI Academy in 1972. Tell us about that.
Yes. So before 1972, women were not permitted to serve as FBI agents in the FBI. And so two females in 1972, after Hoover passed away, Director Hoover passed away, two females went for the first time to the FBI Academy. One was a Marine and one was a nun. And we're very excited to welcome Susan Rowley Malone, who was the Marine at the time, a true trailblazer that set the course for the rest of the women to follow. And so we're looking forward to welcoming her for Women's History Month event, as well as a diversity agent recruitment event later this month in March.
Yeah. Now tell us about that. That's a big recruitment at your office on the south side as you look to grow your ranks. Tell us about this and how people can be part of it.
Yeah, so we're looking for people from all backgrounds, all experiences. It's very important for us to be able to face all the threats that are out there that the FBI deals with day in and day out, is that we have a diversity in our workforce to tackle those threats. And so we're holding a diversity agent recruitment event on March 23rd from 4 to 7 p.m. And you can apply through FBIjobs.gov. And the last day to apply, though, with your application mm-hmm. is March 17th. So we're hoping that people will get that in. It's going to be an exciting event. In addition to having Ms. Malone there, we're also going to have a variety of agents from different backgrounds that tell their stories. So you get to hear how they balance work and family, mm-hmm. as well as their actual story. And then we'll have experts there that will take you through the process, so you'll know exactly how to apply.
Now, as I mentioned, you are the special agent in charge at the FBI field office here in Jacksonville. Not the first, I don't believe, though, for the FBI presence in town. Is that right?
That is correct. I'm happy to say I'm the third female. It's a privilege to serve here, and I've been here for about a year now.
And how do you balance it all? What's the advice you're giving to young women considering a career in the FBI?
So, first of all, I'm just excited to have the opportunity to really have women think about this. Law enforcement isn't always a career that women think of first, and I would like to change that and have them think about it. I think you just have to realize when you're trying to balance a family and you're trying to do this job that you have to give yourself a break and realize that you're not going to be perfect on either side, because it is a balancing act, but We have families here, plenty of women that have both families and a career, and it is doable. It is doable. So I encourage especially throughout this process for those women who haven't thought about this to please consider it and come listen to and hear what we have to say.
And why is it important for the FBI to have a diverse workforce to better meet the national security threats that you deal with on a routine basis?
Well, I think that it is crucial because at the end of the day, we all come from different backgrounds, different cultures. We have different ideas. We see things differently through our eyes, the lens of how we grew up and where we came from. And so when you bring all that together and you have those different thoughts and different experiences, you come at things from a different perspective, and that helps us come up with solutions and to be able to be more robust in our investigations. And as important, it helps us reflect our community, all the communities that we serve out there, that we should look like those communities. So between those two things, I think that for the success of the FBI, it's imperative that we have a diverse workforce.
Check it out online at FBIjobs.gov, and kudos to you. She is Sherry Onks, the special agent in charge at FBI's Jacksonville office. Thanks for being with us as we celebrate Women's History Month. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Melissa.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Well, it is officially spring, and here's an idea for you. You're doing your spring cleaning at home, right? How about doing the same thing with our own St. John's River? That's right. The Great St. John's River Cleanup is happening now through April 22nd. How does it work? Well, the St. John's River Keeper is partnering up with counties throughout Northeast Florida and the St. John's River watershed. And they're inviting people to take part in official cleanups or even organized cleanups of your own. Here to tell us more, Jimmy Orr, the executive director of the St. John's River Keeper. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Meredith Jesperson, their development director. Hey.
Good morning.
All right. So happy spring. Tell us about the Great St. John's River Cleanup, Jimmy.
Well, you know, there used to be years ago a cleanup that involved all the counties in the watershed. Now, the watershed's about, 9,000 square miles. The river runs 310 miles. And unfortunately, when the St. John's River Water Management District stopped hosting this, only a few counties still participate. So we thought, let's bring that concept back, try to get people throughout the entire watershed cleaning up the St. John's. So we're collaborating with several counties throughout the watershed to host cleanups during this period of time from March 18th to April 22nd, as well as nonprofit partners and business partners. So there's a lot of opportunities to participate.
Now, how does it work? If people want to join one of these cleanups that have been organized, they can find them on your website. How do you clean up the river? What do you do?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of places you can go, and we will. Each of the locations will have supplies, grabbers, and trash bags. You just have to register and sign up, and you can go to our website. Actually, there's a page on our website. The easiest is stjohnsrivercleanup.com. If you go to stjohnsrivercleanup.com, we list all of the cleanups, and there you have links to you can register for the various cleanups that you want to participate in.
And you can organize one of your own too, right?
Absolutely.
If you feel like it. Meredith, how does that work?
Correct. So you can let us know. You go on the website. There's a link where you can register your cleanup and take a photo, post it online. And you can do a cleanup just walking your dog or with your friends in the neighborhood. It doesn't have to be mm-hmm. anything formal. All of the trash eventually does go into the river. So you don't have to be on the water to do the cleanup.
So a lot of it is cleaning up litter along the shore.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Whether you're walking on the shore in your neighborhood, it really doesn't matter. It's all it all helps eventually.
How much gets picked up? I bet there's a lot.
A lot. So we did a cleanup on Saturday with Duval County, and so far we've registered over 7,000 pounds of trash just in one day that was picked up.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, and that was only in 13 sites around the city.
So this is a small way people can make a difference.
Correct, correct.
Yeah, and I think that's important because, you know, Jimmy, people know that the river needs work and that there are algae blooms in the river and a lot of issues, but they might feel powerless to do anything about it. This gives people a chance to take some action.
Absolutely. I think that's the thing about cleanups that are so great is people go out and they can see the fruits of their labor, so to speak. They go out, they see the trash, and they can see that they've made a difference in one day. And I think it really does add up because, as Meredith said, you know, all these storm drains, especially in the older neighborhoods, they go straight to the river. And so anything that is on the land can potentially end up in the river. So it's important that we clean up both the watershed and the land, but also the water and the shoreline. And I think this is a great way, too. People can do it, as Meredith said, individually. We've got a grant from the Bronco Wild Fund, which is going to help support this cleanup. And one of the things that you can do is if you tag us and all the information's on our website, you can actually win a $1,000 gift card at the end of this cleanup.
Nice. And that can be used for what? It's just cash? You can use it anywhere?
$1,000 nice. Visa gift card.
Very nice. Now, what are some other things people can do to reduce nutrients in the river? I know I've asked you this many times before, but for people that are just learning about it, what else can people do?
Well, this is an important time of the year, obviously, because it's the time people start fertilizing their yards. So I think it's really about trying to reduce the amount of fertilizer you're using, practice river-friendly practices. We have actually a whole section on our website as well that you can learn about how you can reduce your impact, partly by some of your landscaping practices and trying to keep these fertilizers out of the storm drain, out of the river. And that's really important. And I think right now is really important time, too, with voting. You can vote for river-friendly candidates. And so we're really encouraging people to get out there, learn about the candidates' positions on the river. You can go to our website, actually, too. Again, we did a survey. All of the, except for Daniel Davis, all the major candidates for mayor actually filled out the candidate survey. So you can learn about what their positions are. We're going to do the same in the runoff for the candidates that win or that go to the next round of the elections.
Have you endorsed any candidates?
We don't endorse. We're a 501c3, so we can't endorse. What we just like to do is put the information out there and then let the voters make their decisions based on the responses from the candidates.
All right. And Meredith, this cleanup is just one of a lot of initiatives and events that the Riverkeeper does all through the year.
Correct. We have the cleanups throughout the month. We have an oyster roast in November. That's our big fundraiser. We have educational opportunities throughout the year for students and schools, including boat trips for Title I students. And then we also do a lot of educational opportunities for adults, whether it's bird watching opportunities or hikes along the shoreline to learn about the flora and fauna.
For people that have never gotten out on the water, what's that experience like for them when you go and you do the tours?
I think, you know, you hate to say something's life-changing, but I think it really can be life-changing for people because it's a completely different perspective. If you've never gotten off the shore and really looked at the city from a different point of view, it really can take your breath away and change your perspective.
We're so lucky to have this river, but I feel as though the city takes it for granted in many ways, and you're there to remind people that it's important. Jimmy?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things is that, you know, if we don't protect this river, it can continue to decline in health, and it will affect our quality of life. It will affect our economy. So it's essential that we do whatever we can to clean up. And I think that's saying these cleanups are a great way people can do it. There's a lot of things you can do, like we mentioned, in your yard with river-friendly practices. Voting for candidates that are going to actually put policies in place that protect the river is essential. And so what we need is an engaged constituency for the river. And that's one of the things we try to do is give people those opportunities that they can feel like they can be empowered to make a difference.
Now, in addition to not using fertilizer that causes algae blooms, aren't you supposed to not let your yard waste go into the drains either? Isn't that part of the problem?
Absolutely. That old adage, only rain down the storm drain, because anything that goes in there, it can be your lawn clippings. They have nutrients in the lawn clippings as well that add to the nutrient problem, which causes the algae blooms. So, yes, it's essential that you don't put anything down the storm drain, whether it's chemicals or pesticides or fertilizer or your lawn clippings.
Catherine emails the show. We also need to encourage people to stop littering because it all ends up in the river.
Absolutely.
You wouldn't have this big cleanup if people would just not litter everywhere they go.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing. We have a young professionals group, our Rising Tides group, They've been doing a monthly cleanup of McCoy's Creek, different sections of it, for 10 years. And it's amazing the amount of trash after 10 years they still collect, because unfortunately we still have a major problem with littering. So I think that's also part of it, is the education and getting people to understand the importance of not littering, so that we can hopefully in the future not have have so many cleanups.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I always want to have you on to talk about what you do with the Riverkeeper, because it is so important. And Meredith, can you talk a little bit about how the Riverkeeper works in concert with other organizations? For example, there's a big push right now to build up the riverfront downtown, to make it even more of an attraction, to make the waterfront more attractive for more people.
Right.
What's the Riverkeeper's role in all of that?
Yeah, so we actually work collaboratively with most of your big players downtown as far as, you know, the development, and we really try to be not just a partner, but also an advisor as needed, as people are trying to figure out what is best for the river, and not just in Jacksonville, but throughout the entire watershed. We're working with water management districts, you know, starting in Vero Beach all the way up. So we really try, we have folks on the ground throughout the watershed working with the different organizations to make sure that it's a collaborative effort everywhere. We want to be a player wherever we can.
And when we talk about other water management districts and water in other parts of the state, can you bring us up to date on, this has been a long simmering controversy, Central Florida wanting to take water from the St. Johns River in North Florida and use it down there?
Well, that's,
where are things with that?
That, you know, those plans have not gone away, unfortunately. They've kind of simmered down. We haven't heard as much in a while, but with all of the growth and development that's occurring in Central Florida and really throughout the state and throughout the watershed of the St. Johns, there's going to be a need for more water. And we have almost, you know, reached the limits of the aquifer, which is where most of our water comes from. So obviously what they're looking to is other sources, what they call alternative sources of water. And one of those sources is the surface waters of the St. Johns.
And you're obviously opposed to that?
We have major concerns about that, absolutely, because, you know, one of the things that we've seen is with the decline in the flow of springs, which springs provide 30% of the freshwater flow to the St. Johns. So that reduces the flow of the St. Johns. And then we're seeing also, as sea level rise, salt water is pushing farther upriver. And so we need more freshwater back into the system of the St. Johns. We can't take water from it. One of those things that we're working on that would do that is actually restoring the Ocklawaha River, which is a major tributary of the St. Johns. If we remove the Rodman Dam or a portion of the Rodman Dam, restore that natural flow, that would put about 150 million gallons of fresh water back into the St. Johns River system, which would be huge benefit for the river.
And any forward movement on that?
We're making progress, we feel. We've got a major coalition of 60 organizations throughout the state that have been working on this for the last few years, and we feel like there is some progress. We're not sure when it's going to exactly happen, but we are getting some movement with some of the legislators who have been in opposition to this.
In the meantime, people can join a cleanup or start one of their own. Tell us one more time how.
Absolutely. Visit stjohnsrivercleanup.com. It's the easiest way to see which cleanups are going on throughout the month and also register your own cleanup.
Check it out. Jimmy Orth, Meredith Jesperson, both with the Riverkeeper. As always, great to see you. Thank you.
Great to see you. Thanks. Get out there and vote.
And up next, a ticket giveaway after you vote as the Jumbo Shrimp prepare to kick off their home opener. We'll be right back.
I'm Andrea Kissick, and I lead NPR's new Climate Desk. There are few stories that touch people's lives the way climate change does. Our coverage explores that impact nationally and globally. This year, we're bringing you more climate solutions reporting to look at how we all meet this critical moment together. It really does take all of us. Support the future of NPR's climate journalism by donating to this station right now.
Please call 353-9528, and thank you. This month, millions of people who rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP it's called, are going to lose the extra benefits they got during the pandemic.
My daughter this morning, she was like, "Mom, you need to buy more snacks. There's no snacks over here." I'm like, "You don't say."
I'm Kai Rizdahl, losing those extra SNAP dollars and one family's food budget. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, why the United States has more poverty than any other advanced democracy. We speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Matthew Desmond about the roots of American poverty and how he says so many affluent citizens benefit from government subsidies and exploitation of the poor. His new book is Poverty by America. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Wyoming is banning the sale and prescription of abortion medication. In Texas, a ruling is soon expected that could curtail access to the drug nationwide. But do states have the right to make abortion pills approved by the FDA illegal? We break down the questions and arguments in the ongoing fight to restrict abortion in America. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, spring has sprung, which means it's almost time for the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp to play ball. With more about the new season and keep listening for a ticket giveaway, by the way, we welcome Scott Kornberg, Director of Broadcasting and Media Relations and play-by-play broadcaster for the Shrimp. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. Good to talk to you. Lots of excitement. Tell us all about the home opener coming up soon.
Yeah, well, I can't believe it's 2 weeks from today, which is really wild. But I think that first week is a big, week for everybody. So that home opener, 7:05, April 4th. So we're going to have a street carnival like 3 hours before the game starts outside. Really cool with like rock wall, vendors, all sorts of different stuff out there. A magnet schedule giveaway for the first 3,000 fans. And then it's fireworks, the first of three fireworks this opening week. And then the first of a team record 25 fireworks shows this year. So we really have a lot of stuff that people are looking forward to. And it's crazy. It's 2 weeks from today.
Wow. But you always want to make it all about the fan experience, both on and off the field. That's what makes minor league baseball so fun, I think.
Yeah. And I think, that's a great point you just hit on. In that we're trying to make several different improvements to that fan experience this season. Some of that would be with ticketing, to go to a digital ticketing experience similar to the Jaguars and to the Icemen and the arena, what they do. We've gotten great reviews so far from our season ticket holders on that, the ease of forwarding tickets, the ease of having it on your phone or being able to print it out on your computer. Also doing some different things with our food and beverage experience, because a lot of the times we hear about lines and obviously we want to make sure we're addressing fans' concerns. And so we're having kind of a brand new food and beverage experience throughout the ballpark to try to speed those up, to try to become more efficient in that, so that people could, watch all the entertainment that we have during the game. And kind of on that note, we have a virtual town hall tomorrow from 6 to 7:30. Anybody is welcome to attend. There's a link on our website for that. It's just a Zoom webinar kind of going over some of those new things we're going to roll into the ballpark, some future ballpark improvements that we're hoping to add, not just this year, but in 2024 and beyond. And, definitely want to also hear from our fans as well. So we thought, what better way of sharing these new experiences that'll better the fan experience here at the ballpark than, doing that firsthand with our fans and being able to, if there are any concerns or questions or comments, obviously allowing them to do that right to us. So we have our owner, Ken Babby, our executive VP and GM, Harold Craw, and a couple other people who are really involved with that, but really excited to start to roll that out to the public tomorrow.
And that's tomorrow at 6, just at your website, jackshrimp.com?
Yep. Yeah, there's a link. It says virtual town hall. You click that, and it'll give you another link to register for the town hall right at the top of the page. And it's free for anybody to attend.
check that out, folks, all of Crustacean Nation. And now tell us about some of the big theme nights you're going to have this season, Scott. Those are always fun.
Yeah. Yeah. People always ask me, what did we cook up this year? So every July, I think it's been a new tradition that we're trying to do some sort of crazy, you know, holiday that's not in July, but in July. So we had done Hanukkah, we've done Christmas. This year, we're going to do a Thanksgiving in July to celebrate all things Turkey Day. We've got a Swedish furniture night, which I really thought was pretty funny, in which we're going to have contests to see which fans could assemble, obviously, the furniture that we all struggle with when we bring it back from the store. We've got a Star Wars night. Last year, we had done something really creative, I thought, where the London game, where we kind of brought London to Jacksonville. And so this year we're doing a Dublin in Duval, bringing Ireland a little bit into Jacksonville. We've got dog days, military appreciation nights, where all military members and their families get into the ballpark for free. The dog days, your dog gets to come to the game for free, which is really cool. We have a cat day. I believe we're the only team in minor league baseball to do that. And we actually have a Triassic Ballpark Dinosaur Night. We're hosting Ed's Dinosaurs Live. So that'll be kind of cool. We've never done anything like that in the past. So I think those are a few that I that kind of stuck out to me a little bit. And I guess one more is I want you to want me with fans with existing or outstanding warrants can get into the Jumbo Shrimp game for free. So,
nice.
So you know, we have some very creative people on our staff.
You sure do. I love it. I love it. Well, thank you so much and have fun. By the way, Scott does play-by-play for the Shrimp as well as heading out media relations. Scott Kornberg, we'll see you at the home opener in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. See you in 2 weeks.
And folks, here's the moment. We have one set of four tickets for the home opener of the Jack's Jumbo Shrimp to give away. We're going to give them away to you. Enter now. Email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and put shrimp in the subject line. We'll pick one winner at random. You and your buds can go to the home opener. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Make it a great day and get out and vote.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.